Hey, hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And before we get into this informative and exciting conversation with Dr. Melder about Bitcoin Lake in Guatemala, I want to tell you about this show's fantastic sponsor. To really own Bitcoin and have sovereignty over your money, you need to take self-custody of your Bitcoin and get it off of your exchange. Please go that extra step and secure your Bitcoin from a single point of failure and physical disaster with a Cypher Wheel or the new Cypher Grid seed storage device. CypherSafe provides important, tangible security tools for Bitcoiners. CypherSafe seed storage devices focus on securing your Bitcoin with beautiful, elegant, practical devices that are machined from solid stainless steel. The Cypher Wheel is designed to be physically locked with a padlock and comes with a tamper-evident seal so you can be aware of any attempts to steal your seed words. It's also waterproof, fireproof, rustproof, and foolproof. So keep your sats safe. Go to CypherSafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Dr. Patrick Melder, where we talk about all things Bitcoin Lake, Guatemala, and Bitcoin's holy grail.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Dr. Patrick Melder is a former surgeon, entrepreneur, who is following his dreams. He's a non-toxic Bitcoin maxi, the host of the Mission Bitcoin podcast, and the author of The Christian Case for Bitcoin. He's here to talk about Bitcoin Lake in Guatemala. Patrick, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. How are you?
I'm doing great, Cedric. Thanks so much for having me. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into this conversation. I think we've been DMing now probably for over a year.
For a while, yeah.
Yeah, quite a long time. And at first, it wasn't even about Bitcoin Lake per se. It was about Bitcoin and your writing early on. And I think even a part about your journey. I should have gone back to all the earliest DMs. I just focused on the latest ones you sent me. And I'd love to get you to know you a little bit better. What kind of surgeon were you?
Ear, nose, and throat.
Okay. What are we, are we talking about surgery though? Or as I've gone to an doctor. So what is a routine ENT surgery?
Well, tubes, tonsils, tonsillectomy, thyroidectomy. If you're into facial plastics, you could do a rhinoplasty, a facelift. I had a second specialty of sleep medicine. So I did a lot of surgeries related to prevention of snoring and sleep apnea. Our specialty is also known for doing major head and neck surgeries for taking out cancers of the throat. So, you know, if you see somebody walking around with a hole in their neck and they're breathing through that, that's from throat cancer. So that's in our purview. I did a lot of that when I was training but you know, as you get older and you kind of decide what you like to do, you kind of hone your skills and kind of get into a certain track. So I fell into the snoring and sleep apnea track, and probably for the last, I don't know, 10 to 15 years of my practice, it's kind of a major focus of my practice, and I was very good at it. Got tired of medicine, entrepreneur at heart, and medicine has changed even from the time I was in medical school through my training. So I graduated medical school in 94, and I could see medicine even at that time, even being naive of my career, my future career, I could see that medicine was changing, and it's definitely changed. So, you know, 20 years ago, 80% of physicians worked in a private practice. Nowadays, it's 80% are employed by hospitals. So you just become an employee and you become a cog of the wheel. And so I had enough of it and I was ready to try something different. So that's kind of what I'm doing.
I do want to hang out on surgery a little bit here. Talked a little bit about, I guess, that more of the tail end of your career there. Like we touched on med school touch, but what made you become a surgeon? What made you get into medicine? And I'd love to hear a little bit about going from, okay, I want to get into medicine, I want to be a surgery, to what it's like to practice surgery and then actually perform it for real. And I think surgery is maybe a touch different than sort of maybe general practitioner.
No, that's a great question. So I think my first folly was listening to my high school teacher say, Patrick, I think you should go to medical school. And I grew up in a broken home and in the 70s and didn't really have a lot of direction. So the first direction I got, I kind of took it. And so did pre-med, grew up in Houston in Texas, went to undergraduate at Houston Baptist and then Texas Tech for medical school. And, you know, I must've had some sort of good direction at that time, because when I got into school, medical school, you quickly try to assimilate with the types of people that you want to be with, i.e., you know, are you going to go down the medical track? Are you going to go down the surgical track? And I guess it's so hard, that's so long ago, but I knew from about my second year of medical school that I wanted to be a surgeon. And then once you decide you want to be a surgeon, you have to decide what kind of surgeon you want to be. And, you know, you could be a general surgeon who kind of does everything, but that means you're waking up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and taking care of drunks who are throwing up at you. And I decided I didn't want that lifestyle. And especially when you get to middle age, 50s, you don't want to be waking up in the middle of the night. So, I mean, I at least had that common sense about me. And then I found out about ear, nose, and throat. And I thought, this sounds really intriguing because it has a lot of aspects to being a primary care doctor, because patients will come and see us for sinus issues and, you know, run of the mill stuff. But then you can do very, as I mentioned, very complex surgeries from the smallest bones in the body in the ear to, you know, some of the most intricate muscular apparatus, you know, when you're talking about the vocal cords, because if you mess those up, you know, that's devastating. So, and the other thing that was attractive about ENT surgery in particular, and the correct name of the specialty is otolaryngology head and neck surgery. So otolaryngology is you know, oto ear, larynx is the voice box, and it used to be otorhinolaryngology. But I think one of the really interesting aspects about the specialty that I identified early on is a lot of specialties, you're kind of tracked into a certain demographic, you know, like if you're a gynecologist, you're only going to see women. If you're a urologist, it's usually old white guys. If you're an ophthalmologist, it's old people. And with ear, nose, and throat, you can literally take care of a neonatal patient that was just born to someone who's, you know, 99 years old. So you really get the whole demographic. So that was really attractive. And the anatomy of the head and neck is just fascinating. You really have to think in three dimensions to operate in the close confines of where we operate. So that was kind of the intrigue of the surgery, the ear, nose, and throat in particular. And then, you know, self-selection is very important. It's like being a pilot. A lot of times surgeons are equated to pilots. It takes a certain type of personality to do surgery. And kids in med school find out really quickly. I mean, when you walk in and you see a cadaver, if you have a fainting spell or the first time you walk into the operating room and you hit the floor, which I've seen, you know, you probably don't want to be doing surgery. So that selection process happens pretty early on. I do remember when I was a staff surgeon, I trained at Walter Reed in DC, and then I was on staff there. So I've trained a fair number of surgeons. And I do remember a couple of occasions where we had surgeons that were in their second or third year with a couple more years to go that just weren't cutting the mustard. And somehow they had made it that far. And then you've got to tell somebody, you're not going to be a surgeon. You've got to start over again in your post-medical training. And then the practice of surgery itself. I mean, as strange as it may sound, there's a certain level of bravado with surgeons. And so most surgeons think they can do anything, and that's a good thing, because that's kind of who you want to be in charge when you're under the knife. If it goes to the extreme, obviously that can be really bad. But you know, most of the time when you're doing surgeries, you're very self-confident. It doesn't mean that you're not nervous at times if you've done something that you shouldn't have done, or in a situation where you've gone too far, which has, you know, happened plenty of times. But you know, you have to have a certain level of confidence to be able to put a knife to somebody. I mean, that's, you have to have confidence to do that for sure.
Right. Yeah. I find that fascinating, especially the comparison to pilots. I would have thought at first glance, maybe dental, but as we were talking about this, I think about there's two sort of the mental fortitude and sort of the physical prowess that's needed to do this kind of work. You psychologically need to be able to deal with sort of the human body, but then you need to actually do the work and execute. And I wonder, you know, you touched on a little bit, but I mean, it's got to be a lot different than waking up and going to work and maybe being a spreadsheet jockey or a plumber and kind of where you can kind of get through some tasks and maybe they're routine or routinized. But this just seems to have a whole different aspect of it.
Well, that's the, you know, well, and also the privation. I mean, there's so many times that you're spending hours on your feet, not eating, waking up in the middle of the night. You're right. That's not a spreadsheet jockey. And, you know, some aspects of medicine and surgery are new, and I love to solve problems, and that's always fascinating. But, you know, a lot of it can be very cookbook. And, you know, when someone, you know, when I was in medical school, I remember one of the attending physicians telling the class, you know, when someone comes into your office, you're walking by the bed and on the floor and you're taking a look at a patient, you should be able to diagnose what's going on with somebody within a minute. And sometimes, I found that to be true in the latter part of my career. I by the time patients came and sat down in my office chair, within 2 to 3 minutes, I pretty much knew what was going on, how I was going to treat them. But I had to sit there and be empathetic. And I'm not saying this like I wasn't, I'm just saying that, you know, you're pretty quick to what's going on. You got to, you know what you're going to do, but then to make sure the patient feels like they're getting the care that they need, you right. listen to them and you talk to them a little bit. It can be very cookbook.
Yeah. And I think you touched on it earlier as well, that the medical industry, the hospital business, the practice of medicine has really changed a lot. I think drastically over the last 10 or 20 years. I just went through a very serious situation with my father, and we dealt with the hospital a lot. He was there for over 3 weeks. And, you know, I think while the care was to the highest quality, an isolated sort of practice, no one was looking at the person holistically.
Yep.
And for the amount of money being spent, things could be done drastically different. I even found just the hospital to be incredibly humane with the bright white lights and the way the system is run. And I don't think that's any sort of cog in the wheel's fault. I think just the systemic industrialization of medicine.
Absolutely.
And turning it into sort of a hotelier type practice.
No question.
Really difficult. But at the same time, when you need help and you need that care, I mean, it's the best place to go. But I would like to see a lot of change there. And it seems like you made a lot of change in your life from going practicing medicine. Tell us a little bit about maybe some of your entrepreneurial endeavors.
Yeah. So, you know, I spent 13 years active duty and I finished my military career in 2006. And I was going to be a lifer, but I have a very inventive mind, and I had invented something, and I decided I wanted to leave the military to pursue becoming an entrepreneur. So I started my first company, which was a medical device company. This was in 2006. So, you know, we were coming up on the first financial crisis. We were in the middle of a fundraise, couldn't raise money. And that first company went on until about 2011, but after the financial crisis, it was just very difficult to raise money. And then my second company, which I currently still have, I invented another nasal rinse system with a novel product that, that was the other thing that was difficult in the latter years of my career in medicine, is trying to juggle being a full-time entrepreneur, a full-time surgeon. And, you know, it was just too much and I had to make a decision. And I'm thankful that I made the decision to step away from medicine, but it's given me more time to focus on what I love doing. And, you know, that's kind of part of what the project in Guatemala, it's born out of that for sure.
Yeah. Let's get a little bit more into what you love doing and what you've been up to recently. So How did you and your family start going to Guatemala? How often have you been there?
Yeah, so when we first moved here to Georgia, that was in 2009, we attended a church not far from where we live. And we were listening to this couple that had left from the church, and they had gone down to Guatemala, and they were serving in this small community called Panajachel on this lake, Atitlan. And my wife decided that we should go down there and kind of see what they're doing. So one thing led to another. And that next summer, I took my three girls and my wife, and we went down and we did an art camp there in Panajachel. And my girls at the time were, you know, upper middle school, high school. And we did that for 6 years. So from 2012 to 2018, we went down there every summer. And then when my girls got older and it was kind of like herding cats, we just couldn't make it down there again. We stopped doing that, but the lake is a beautiful lake. It's one of the top 10 most beautiful lakes in the world. The people are just so warm and friendly. Guatemala is just a great country, except the political structure and the corruption. It's just a great country. And so as I was getting deeper and deeper into Bitcoin and thinking about how Bitcoin could help transform lives and whatnot, I automatically just started thinking back to Panajachel. And I guess, Cedric, the other thing that's really important about this journey for me is just having grown, I didn't grow up in the church, but having spent a lot of time of my life in the church and being all around the world doing mission work, Christian mission work, one of the things that's very difficult to do is to provide financial aid or support without creating dependence. And so that's what I saw in Bitcoin, is a way to finally take the technology of Bitcoin, the money of Bitcoin, provide a vehicle where we could provide economic independence without dependence. And that's really kind of the thesis and the basis of what we're doing, obviously based on the work that Mike Peterson and crew have done in El Zante. But I was heavily influenced by reading Alex Gladstein's work and all the humanitarian stuff. Really influenced my thinking. So that's kind of the nexus between, you know, why this gringo is down in Guatemala.
There's a lot to unpack there. I think maybe we'll start with what role does the church play in your life and in your family's life, and how important is family to you, considering you grew up came from a broken home?
Wow, that's a great question. That's a pretty deep question. Family is very important to me. And, without getting too personal, I never, growing up in my home, I can't remember a time I heard "I love you" ever. And so that's like paramount in my house. My kids, my wife, whenever we leave or whenever we come, those are the first words that we say. And those are the last words we speak, even on the phone, because I want the girls and my wife to always know that. So the church has been very important. My faith is very important. I wouldn't, if it wasn't for the Army and my faith, I wouldn't be who I am today. So it's very important for sure. Yeah. And that's really, and the other really important aspect to this work, Cedric, is while my faith informs what I'm doing, the work that we're doing down in Guatemala is not evangelical at all. It's just what motivated me to go down there. So we're not down there, preaching or anything like that. We're just down there to help the community and bring this wonderful technology that you and I both love.
You also mentioned, you love or like to give aid and support without creating dependence. I think that's a really great way to frame it. I'm kind of curious when you came across Bitcoin and what your rabbit hole story is. Because I'm kind of curious when all these events kind of merged together.
Yeah, great question. So I was, like every Bitcoiner, we all have those near misses. So my first interaction with Bitcoin was like in 2013, but, I was just too busy with what was going on. I just kind of dismissed it. But then it was in 2018, actually, kind of in the deep bear market, that I rediscovered it again and bought my first Bitcoin. Actually, I was on vacation in Puerto Vallarta, and just had time to kind of read about it. And I immediately understood the implications of not Bitcoin per se, but the blockchain that it was built on and the transformation that it could provide in developing countries. You know, if there's a civil war or, you know, civil strife and you're kicked off your land in a lot of these countries, you may never get it back. But I saw immediately that with something like Bitcoin and the blockchain, you could have, you know, permanent record of your property. So that was my, so I started DCAing. I didn't know it at the, that's what it was at the time, you know, big among Bitcoiners right now. I mean, obviously that's what it was, but I started doing that. And then I it was really at the tail end of 2019 and the beginning of the pandemic that I really started going deep, deep down the rabbit hole. And I think that I was telling the story the other day, actually down in Guatemala, that the, you know, without getting political, I think most people would say that the 2020 election and leading up to that, there was a lot of just weirdness, and it just made me ask and a lot of questions. And I read, my brother had recommended The Creature from Jekyll Island, and he wasn't even a Bitcoiner. He just recommended that I read the book. And then when I read that, you start asking other questions. And then we all know that where that leads once you get a hold of Bitcoin. So, and that's where it started. Yeah.
What was kind of the role of money in your life maybe before this, or in terms of, you know, I'm thinking surgeon, entrepreneur, I think sort of the thought process for that model, a lot of anyone who's sort of like producing eventually has to spend maybe even, you know, a third of their time, you know, if you're a surgeon, then a third of your time as an entrepreneur, and then a third of your time, you know, managing whatever you can, a value you can save. So yeah. What were you thinking about money maybe leading up to 2018 as your dad? Like, were you kind of thinking, were you a gold bug? Were you thinking that money?
No, man. I was just so freaking busy with everything right. that I was doing, and my, you know, supporting three girls through college, and, you know, I don't drive a fancy car, and, you know, we live in a nice house, but it's not like, you know, certainly not the biggest in the area. But I think probably just trying to raise a family, even on a surgeon's salary can be challenging. And I don't want that to come across as dismissive at all. You know, we all have certain lifestyles, but I can assure you, if anybody knows me or visits me, that they know I do not have an extravagant lifestyle. So I think that was probably the other thing that was so frustrating about doing what I was doing. I was working very hard, just keeping up, you know, saving, but not like I would have expected. And certainly with the surgeon salary, I would have expected to accumulate a lot more. But we really suffered during the first financial crisis. We were underwater on our home in Maryland after I got out of the Army, and we held on to that thing until about 2018. And we lost a lot of money because of the financial crisis. And I took out a mortgage on that first home, over leveraged mortgage at the time, if you recall. I mean, people were getting 80%, 100% loan to value. And so that's what I did to start my first company. And then, so, you know, here you are trying to be an entrepreneur, a good citizen, the big banks get the bailouts, and you're just struggling and you're just being an entrepreneur. And it just, I felt, I used to watch the movie, The Big Short, and I love the movie, but I used to get so freaking angry watching that movie, you know?
Yeah. I love that movie too. The blood boils though. I think especially with the medical industry, if you call it that, a lot of people just don't recognize or see maybe are aware of the hidden costs to doctors, like malpractice insurance or educational loans. Everyone sort of has their financial structure and you know, there's a lot of hidden costs in some of these endeavors. I'd love to turn, I went to Costa Rica, which is maybe two or three countries away from Guatemala, for my honeymoon. We loved it. Political corruption seems to be low there. you know, there's no standing military. It's quite safe. Maybe the only low note is the food's a little bland in general. What is Guatemala like? And you mentioned, you know, maybe there's in the politics, there's corruption.
Yeah. Well, I've been to, I've been to every Central American country except Panama, Honduras, and Nicaragua. And I've been to Costa Rica. So, yes, Costa Rica is a beautiful country. It's got a very middle-class feel to it and definitely feels very safe. We spent time at a resort on the West Coast and some time in San Juan, but, you know, Guatemala is an absolutely gorgeous country. The people are tremendously friendly. The climate will beat anything, at least in Guatemala City and in Panachel in the Western Highlands. It's just pretty temperate, very nice temperature. Very mild. You don't need air conditioning. You might need some heat on some days in the morning and night, but it's just very comfortable living. The corruption is not something that you see. Like, you can't point at something and say that person's corrupted. I think in a lot of these developing countries, you can see corruption with the lack of infrastructure and the way things look. And one thing about because you know, a lot of money is being spent. Like, I was just thinking about this on my last trip. I was driving through the mountains to Panachel from the city, and you know, they've got these giant mountainscapes or hills that they've kept carved into to build the roads. And they've got, to prevent mudslides, they've got these concrete sheets or facades on the dirt. And I'm looking at the, you know, if we're in the U.S., that concrete would probably be about 4 to 8 inches thick, holding the mountain back. But there in Guatemala, it looks like, you know, the dried frosting on a chocolate covered donut. You know, if you could just poke it, you'd feel like the whole thing would just come out at you. So someone made a lot of money doing that, and they probably that 4 to 8 inches of concrete that they should have put went into their pocket instead. So that's the corruption. And then Guatemala's got a really brutal history. They had a 40-year civil war, and the military and the business leaders run the country, and the government is completely corrupted in all branches by, they have a name for it, but there's this, when the military was in control of the government, part of the peace deal, they had to kind of exit, you know, the government system. But because they had been a part of the institutions for so long, they basically left behind their culture within the government. And so it's exceedingly corrupt. I don't remember the statistics, but I think 3 or 4 of the last presidents have all either served time in jail or been, you know, fined for corruption. It's really bad.
Wow. And what are the living standards like in Guatemala? What is a typical home like, or structure of the residency or town like?
You know, Guatemala City is a big, I don't remember the population, but it's millions, 4 to 5 million people that live in Guatemala City. And it really depends on where you go in the city. You can go into certain parts of the city, and it may look like just maybe just a little bit more run down than certain other big cities in the U.S. But and then obviously they've got parts of the city that are pretty rough with, you know, the main mode of transportation is the motorcycle. And certainly there are certain zones, Guatemala City is broken into zones, and there are certain zones that you definitely don't want to go through night or day. But then as you get farther out from the main city, you get into some of the smaller towns, and, you know, the homes are simple. Most of them are, you know, they're all cinder block homes. And, you know, the middle class doesn't really exist in Guatemala. You've got the pretty wealthy upper class, and then the kind of the middle poor, and then the very poor. And so you can see really nice homes, or you can see people living in shanties. It's kind of a typical third world country look. It doesn't look or feel like Africa or India, but you know, I have this saying that poverty looks the same no matter where you are in the world. And it's true. I mean, poverty's poverty. I mean, you can go to some parts of the Deep South or Appalachia and see probably the same type of poverty that you do in Guatemala for sure.
Yeah. What is the lake like? How'd you find this lake? And what is maybe the economy like around the lake?
Great question. So we found it through our work in Panachel. So Panachel is right there on the lake, and Panachel is kind of the gateway to the lake. Most people, when they come to the lake, come to Pana, and they kind of use that as their launch point to go to different cities around the lake. And there are 12 to 17 cities around the lake. Panachel is a community of about 20,000 people, very touristy, a lot of expats, a lot of gringos and Westerners there, but still very Guatemalan. I mean, you can definitely, if you don't know some Spanish, you might have a little trouble kind of navigating just the daily doings within Panachel. There are other parts of the lake where, like San Marcos, which is on the western side, all part of mainly expats, kind of a hippie culture. You probably don't even need to know Spanish to live there. It's probably pretty easygoing. You've got kind of a hipster, young vibe town in San Pedro. And then in Santiago de Atitlan, which is straight across from Pana, which is the largest city on the lake. It's about 50,000 people. It's a very, you go there and you don't see that many tourists at all. You see mainly Mayans and indigenous Guatemalans and indigenous Mayans. And so you get really kind of a different feel. And the part of the country that we're in, because it's an indigenous area, the government, obviously the government has its tentacles everywhere, but in a lot of these communities, they're kind of a community of their own. And a lot of times they take justice into their own hands. If the police don't take care of a matter, there's been instances of vigilante justice. So they're very protective of their culture and their social structure in that area.
Wow. I find that every country tends to have a unique relationship with their indigenous people. What is the relationship between the Guatemalans that are not indigenous, and I assume maybe they control the power structures, and the indigenous Mayans?
I mean, that's it. So when you get to Guatemala, there's a light-skinned Guatemalan. I mean, they may be a little bit darker than us, but not too much. And then you've got the very darker-skinned Mayan descent, and the lighter-skinned Guatemalans are usually from Spanish colonial descent. And when the Spanish ruled Guatemala and Central America, it was the Spanish descendants that were in control of the government. So the lighter skin, it's almost like a caste system that you'd see in India. So the lighter skinned Guatemalans are usually in positions of power, not always, but that's a very broad brush statement. And during the Civil War, the indigenous people were considered the rebels, and the military just horrendous atrocities against the indigenous. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people just disappeared in the hands of the military. So there's a healthy distrust between the indigenous people and the central authorities for sure.
Great. Okay. I'm kind of curious, how long does it take to get to Pana from when you land at the nearest major airport?
Well, it depends. Guatemala City it's got the international airport, and depending on the traffic in the city, if there's no traffic in the city, it's about 3 hours. And then depending on the time of day, it could be about three and a half hours. Yeah.
What is that trip like? Is it smooth paved road or?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, okay. For probably, I would say 2.5 hours, pretty easy going, smooth paced. I mean, when you get into some of the villages, you're going over speed bumps and stuff like that. But then as you're getting closer to Pana, especially this time of year with the rainy season, In fact, this last time I was there, we had to kind of ford through a little river, not river, but creek. And, you know, when I did that with my wife the first time, she was kind of freaking out a little bit, but, you know, it's not bad, actually. It's really not bad at all.
Nice. I just remember in Costa Rica, the ride from the airport to even the local, like the nearest one of the local cities was brutal. I mean, you had a lot of roads that wouldn't exist if there were heavy rains and stuff. I mean, it was brutally fun, but, you know, it just wasn't smooth going, all of it. So we're going to this beautiful lake. We got to get into it. What is the purpose? What is the mission here? What is happening?
The mission is to create a Bitcoin circular economy, AKA Bitcoin Beach in Guatemala, so to speak. We use that as our model. And the, you know, I visited El Zante, I talked to Mike Peterson. They've been a great support. And so I took the lessons learned and focused on educating children. So we reconnected with Nancy, who owns the school, and did a scouting. My wife and I did a scouting trip last December to reconnect with her and say, hey, we want to bring this technology, Bitcoin, and we want to teach the kids about Bitcoin. And then on top of that, we wanted to add this component of Bitcoin mining. And the reason for that is we don't have an endowment like Bitcoin Beach. So as you know, Bitcoin Beach was given a number of Bitcoin to start their project. We don't have that. We've bootstrapped everything. And then the other very unique thing that we'll get into is the lake is a dying lake. It's very similar to Lake Tahoe. You and I are think about the same age, but you know, Lake Tahoe in the 80s and 90s was dying, and massive campaign to clean Lake Tahoe. But there is no economic incentive or money to clean this lake. And so with all of my education and reading about Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining and green energy revolution related to Bitcoin mining, I thought, wow, this would be such a great thing to bring down there. We bring Bitcoin mining down to inject Bitcoin into the economy because we've got to have Bitcoin to feed the circular economy. Then if we could get everybody economically aligned and incentivized to use Bitcoin mining as a means to clean the lake, then there won't be any political clashes over, you know, what are you doing with my lake or my land or whatever. And so when I was first envisioning this, before I had boots on the ground myself, scouting everything out, the plan was to kind of follow the ARK investment and Square white paper using solar battery and Bitcoin mining to kind of build out this electrical infrastructure. And I was on a Twitter Spaces kind of describing the project, and Ricardo Camarón was on the space, who's now become part of the project. He suggested that we look into biomining. So on my first real trip down there to kind of really start the program in January, I went to the wastewater treatment facility on his suggestion and found, you know, this facility that is trying its best to clean the water, but they've got this giant biodigester, 300 square meter biodigester, that normally in a normal wastewater treatment facility is venting or flaring methane and containing or scrubbing the CO2. But this thing has leaks in it, and so they can't flare the methane, so it's just leaking out in the environment. And methane is a worse environmental gas than CO2, depending on who you read. I read an article the other day. You know, methane could have upwards of an 84x more harmful impact on the environment than CO2. In fact, the article I was reading is that if we could control the methane problem, we're going to be able to more quickly and more effectively control the environment and the greenhouse gases than if we just looked at CO2 alone. So methane's really bad. So when I looked at that, I fed all the information to Ricardo, and we came up with a plan to basically cap the biodigester, trap the methane, and then use that, flare it, and turn a generator so we could mine Bitcoin. And so that's kind of where that started. So we went from solar to capping the methane. And then when we cap the methane, we immediately fix an environmental problem. So that's one of those Bitcoin fixes. We could immediately come in and take care of this problem just by hooking up a miner to the wastewater treatment facility. But then we started looking at all the other issues that are around the lake, and there's a lot of organic waste that just decomposes. And, you know, if you've ever been by a very large landfill here in the US and you drive by and you see these pipes coming up out of the ground, those are pipes that are venting the methane that's a product of decomposition. So in Guatemala, they basically have an open landfill. Normally when you're working on solid waste, you want to create basically a tomb, a sterile tomb that's impervious to leakage into the groundwater. But, you know, there they don't do that. They just literally take the trash up to a hill, dig a big hole, dump the dump truck up and dump the trash and go on to the next thing. And then that the landfill for Pana is about 800 feet above the city. And when it rains, all that waste and all that decomposition, decomposing organic material just runs down into the watershed into the lake. And that's in Pana, you know, and if we've got 17 cities around the lake, it's happening in every community. And then you've got all the smaller villages and or farms, hundreds of farms that line the lake where it's repeated over and over and over again. And so is that providing good context for you?
Yeah, I'm trying to get a little bit more fill though. So I know you were recently down in Guatemala. You went with some entrepreneurs, some Bitcoiners, people who are interested in what's going on. Well, what is the holy grail of Bitcoin? What do you mean by that? What is a pot of gold and the hidden jewels? Yeah, I kind of understand the process, but I want to understand a little bit more about why are we treating the water? Why do we? And so tell me a little bit more about maybe the holy grail and the hidden jewels.
Well, the holy grail of Bitcoin is free energy. So, you know, as most Bitcoiners know, the power structures, power grids are usually around population centers because exporting energy to smaller communities can be difficult. And so when you look at a community like Panajachel and the surrounding lake, they have every form of renewable energy you could imagine. They've got sun, they have hydro, geothermal, wind. They've got this biomass, biomining. So they have all this wasted energy that could be captured, but there's never, before Bitcoin, there was never an economic incentive to capture any of this energy. So the holy grail is to find the cheapest renewable energy. And we on this last trip, we identified probably it will be the holy grail. If we can prove it out, it will definitely be the absolute cheapest form of energy for Bitcoin mining. So I'm obviously not disclosing too much information about it because there's some proprietary technology involved, but we're super excited about what we could do in that part of Guatemala for sure.
And from what you can tell us, is it related to wasted methane?
No, because okay. It has to do with the water that's behind me. So we've identified some proprietary technology that can really do some tremendous things with the lake water and help us mine Bitcoin.
Right. And what have you guys learned from Bitcoin Beach?
Well, I think the number one lesson is the age that you need to educate, that you need to start at. I think the number two lesson, number three lesson, number four lesson, number five lesson, et cetera, is education, education, education. And I think if anything that we've seen, and I think that most of us kind of, not regret is the wrong word, but I think Bukele's top-down approach has left a lot of missing pieces of education in the middle where, you know, a lot of people, I heard it today, I was on a Zoom call, people go to, you know, San Salvador and And there aren't that many places you can really identify where you can pay with Bitcoin, even though they're all supposed to take it. And if they do say that they, if there's a sign on the wall that says they take it, you can walk in and the attendant says, well, the wallet's not working today. You know, the Bitcoin machine's not working today, or whatever the excuse is. So, and if you go to El Zante, the epicenter, obviously you can pretty much pay for everything with Bitcoin. So education is absolute key to anything. And Mike Peterson told me, said, you know, make sure that when you're building these businesses out and onboarding these businesses, that you go back and make sure that you support them. And because we kind of suffer between a chicken and egg thing, you know, we want to onboard these businesses. We want to bring Bitcoin tourists, but Bitcoin tourists aren't going to come if there's not any place to spend Bitcoin. And so you're kind of chasing your tail for a while until there's enough momentum that, and or people finally start getting it, that you're at a tipping point. So we're almost there. We're almost there.
Right. And how did you guys come up with the logo?
Well, okay. So we started the project as Bitcoin Lake. And when logo is lake in Spanish, the G in the logo is a Quetzal bird, which is the national bird of Guatemala. Any Guatemalan that looks at that logo instantly knows that it's a Quetzal bird. And the Quetzal is also the name of the currency. So that's how we came up with the logo. Yeah.
Right. And I'm a little bit more curious about the wasted methane, though, and the biodigester.
Yeah, biodigester.
Okay, so with the wasted methane, though, so what? I get that we have trapped release. I guess this is from biomass from like a garbage dump.
Yes.
And, but did you guys come across someone who had like a biodigester?
Yeah. So that's a crazy thing. So yes. So we, on this trip in particular, we wanted to identify a landowner, a private landowner, because we have another technology where we want to bring down there. But we figured it'd be a lot easier to do this on somebody's private land than to bring this technology into the municipal property. So we meet this guy. We have a full-time guy that works for us down there, Eleazar. He does a fantastic job. And so he contacted this guy. We met with him. And we kind of described what we're doing. You know, we want to build a biodigester. We want to put a bunch of organic waste in it. And we want to capture the methane and create Bitcoin with that. And, you know, we mentioned that within like the first 5 minutes of our conversation. And then, you know, the conversation was going on and on and on. And then about an hour into the conversation, he mentions that, I've installed 3 biodigesters. And we all just looked at each other and said, wait, we got to go see these. So sure enough, Cedric would go, you know, 4 miles outside of town up the mountain. And we're looking at, you know, you ever been driving by in the country and you see this giant white LP propane tanks where you know, the gas companies come and fill up their trucks and, you know, the big bullet looking things. Well, these things are like that big, just 1,000-liter biodigesters, just empty and not being used. And so we were talking about how much money we needed to raise to build a biodigester. And then lo and behold, we've got 3 of these things that aren't even being used. And that's a perfect example of corruption, where something $300,000 was spent installing those. Certainly somebody pocketed some money somewhere along the way. There was no plan to follow up or follow through. You know, once you install these things, what's the next step? And
yeah, that's wild.
Yes, very wild.
Yeah. And speaking about a circular economy, how do you see Bitcoin? And I know this is a loaded term, and I know you don't mean it in the way a lot of people interpret this, but how does Bitcoin maybe bring about some sort of form of UBI? And in this case, I'm guessing we don't mean, you know, a handout from the government, from the producers to the takers, but some sort of productive asset that community owns.
I'm totally into that. And that's one of our goals is to take one of the ways I like to describe this, Cedric, is, and I've told the Guatemalans this when I'm talking to them, that, you know, the Spanish came 300-400 years ago. They came, they raped, they took all the gold and raped the land, pillaged the land, took all the gold and sent it back to Spain. And we all think of Bitcoin as digital gold. And so I've told Guatemalans that this digital gold needs to stay here in this community. And especially if we're going to be using natural resources and the energy abundance that's there, I definitely want the local Guatemalans to be benefiting from that. So in my mind, that's a UBI because that kind of describes it. I don't like the term UBI because of the negative connotations associated with it, but you're right. I mean, this is not coming from the state and producers to those who aren't producing. This is going back to the rightful owners of a waste product that we can now monetize.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that would be, empowering to say the least.
Absolutely.
So I believe you were at Bitcoin 2022 in Miami.
Yes.
What was your experience like?
Well, actually I messed up my dates. I was asked to be at the Bitcoin, thank God for Bitcoin, the day before on Tuesday. So I was there for that. And really that's what I was there for. And I had the pleasure of baptizing a mutual friend of ours, yeah. Tomer in the Atlantic, and a friend of his, Lex. But that was my experience. I'm not really sure that I missed much. I think based on the people that went to both Thank God for Bitcoin and the main event, they felt like, put aside the religious aspects of the Thank God for Bitcoin, there was some really seriously good content there, and it was all Bitcoin. You know, you didn't have to kind of weed through all the other shitcoinery, so to speak. But yeah, that was my experience. I mean, I look forward to actually going to the full event next year and getting my dates right.
Yeah. So you've written a book. I think you've written two books, actually. I think I only know
two books.
One.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think they're kind of maybe in this answer could be related, but what does God have to do with Bitcoin?
Well, that's a great question. I think that if you ask that question, what does God have to do with anything? It's not just Bitcoin. So what does God have to do with my car or my job or, you know, my children or my wife? I think that if you come from a certain faith background, like I do, God has everything to do with everything in your life. So in that respect, God has a lot to do with Bitcoin. And, you know, every now and then I get some drive-bys on Twitter about my book. And I think that what people fail to realize is that, you know, there are more verses in the Bible speaking about money than just about any other subject, because the way we treat money is a reflection of how we trust God. So God has a lot to do with Bitcoin for sure. And the case I make in the book is, you know, the Jimmy Song and Jordan Bush book, Thank God for Bitcoin, is a great book. And I read it, and this is no disrespect to them and their work, because it's been very influential to a lot of Bitcoiners, but it's no different than me saying, thank God for Friday, you know, or thank God for my job. We should be thankful for God for Bitcoin, because it's a great invention. No matter your faith, if you serve the God that we're talking about, then yeah, you should be thankful for Bitcoin. What I wanted to do in my book was to look at it purely from a Christian perspective. And, you know, I think we all kind of lament the fact that there's nobody behind Bitcoin. We don't lament it, but, you know, there's no marketing agency behind Bitcoin, you know, there's no group of people behind Bitcoin, and it's up to each one of us to promote Bitcoin. But I think as a group of people with a common ethos and belief, Christians should be the ones that are behind Bitcoin and pointing to it and promoting it. But unfortunately, the corruption of our monetary system, it makes even talking to Christians about Bitcoin, they treat it like an investment. And that's not, I think you and I look at it far more than investment. We look at it as a transformational technology. And that's kind of how I try to approach the book. I look at it from a moral perspective and the transformation that it can bring. And so that's what that book's about. And then the second book, The Philosophy of Bitcoin and Religion, is really kind of for our atheist friends who are looking at Bitcoin as something more than what it is. And reading John Vallis's latest, one of his latest pieces, I think it was The Money Messiah or whatever the one that he based on Jordan Peterson's work, that just sent me over the edge. And I felt like I had to write something that really went through a logical progression of, no, Bitcoin's not a God. It is transcendent, but it is not the transcendent. So that's kind of the difference between the two books. Yeah. Thanks for asking.
Yeah. I have a few more questions. I had J.M. Gordon Bush on the show, episode 38. And we did discuss Thank God for Bitcoin there in depth. I thought it was really interesting going over a lot of the proverbs.
He's a great guy. He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah.
And very knowledgeable. And it was very interesting. I do think that Bitcoin is ethical in the sense what sort of religion looks for in money and the conversation around money. And I have a friend who's very close friend who's getting very close on his Christianity, on his path. But we were having a conversation about money, and the debate was around, I was trying to get across the point that like debt is bad. Money can be used in harmful ways, but money in and of itself is and should not be a good or a bad thing. Kind of like a hammer is not a good or a bad thing.
That's right.
A tool. And you can use that hammer to build a house, or you could use that hammer to destroy a house. And
that's right.
You know, it's how it's used. I had Jimmy Song on the show, episode 18. We talked a lot about the golden handcuffs and work and freedom. But you said something that was very interesting, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about it. What do you mean by how you treat money is how much you trust God? I think it was how much you said, but some sort of relationship between treating money and trust of God.
Well, I think that the easiest way to describe this would be, you know, Jesus said that it's easier for a rich man to go through the, no, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. So people who have means don't need to rely on anything or anyone. Okay. When you don't have means, you are more apt to look for help. And for many people, that help is God. So, if you don't have a roof over your head, or if you don't have your next meal, or, you know, if you're down and out, you're seeking help. And for a lot of people, that help is God. When you have everything in the world that you need, you become an island unto yourself. And I mean, that's not just my observation. I think that's historically just, you know, why does power corrupt and absolute, or whatever the term is. I mean, once you have a certain level of power or money, you get very, very far away from needing anything or asking for help. And trusting in God is the absolute pinnacle of dependence, for sure. Yeah. And if you don't have money, you tend to fall on your knees more than if you have a lot of it.
I agree with that final statement a lot. And I agree with the sentiment. What I have seen some, I'm not speaking from personal experience, but when I've seen very successful people, successful being financially, when they, not all financially successful people, but I think there's some that recognize that they've mastered certain realms, and then there's almost maybe nowhere else to look but the spiritual realm. If maybe they've exceeded their ability to be content, they've gone on all the vacations, it is that fulfills them materially or physically. I've seen some people turn to spirituality in the sense of what is next? What, how can I find fulfillment beyond these things I've conquered? I get what you're saying about hubris and arrogance and sort of maybe less people on that extreme side of the spectrum turn to spirituality, but I've seen some. And it seems to be a natural progression to me where I think if you go through what be made a secular, a secularly successful life where you grow up and you maybe, you know, chase partnership and you're trying to find romance and love, then you conquer career and that thing maybe a little later than you should. And then you turn to legacy, then you turn to spirituality. I've seen that sort of arc on people that sort of have conquered the secular path.
I don't think that is the human plight. That's the human story, right? So God has implanted in everyone's heart heaven. The question of what is out there and is there something more out there? That's the human quest. So I don't think that what the wealthy or successful person is doing is unique to the fact that they have money. That is a human quest. I think that what makes it interesting for you or us to see someone like that do that is, wow, we thought they had everything. And so that becomes interesting for us because we think internally that the next thing, I need the next promotion or whatever. But we're not interested in the plight of the plumber that's, you know, barely getting by, because that's not who we are, you know, and he may be having the same thoughts, but he's in a more desperate situation. So the more acute need for him is the money aspect. But he's on the same spiritual quest, but it's in a different light. And we relate more to the people that are more like us.
Yeah. One of the most striking anecdotes I ever heard, I used to meet with I call him a rabbi. I don't meet with him very frequently at all recently, but he told me there was a billionaire. He's still around. He was a hedge fund manager. Came from the maybe nefarious backgrounds, but made a lot of money. And lived, you know, had an apartment overlooking Central Park and a house in upstate New York with his own personal zoo, like Michael Jackson.
Wow.
And, you know, never walked around with less than a wad of, you know, this thick of $1,000 bills to never feel as poor as he did when he was a kid and yada, yada. And after kind of, you know, has a beautiful house in, it's not Acapulco, but the most expensive city in the world or whatever it is. And the only thing that he gets pleasure from now is watching his favorite tree grow. As what I dwell on that a lot, because he's just done everything in the material, physical realm, good or bad, whatever. And there's not much left to do but contemplation.
Cedric, that's if you read the Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, I mean, that's essentially what Solomon said and the closing of Ecclesiastes. I mean, life is meaningless. There's nothing left to do except serve God and him alone. So, you know, if I hope in his contemplation of watching the tree, he's also contemplating who God is. I think that would be the greater thing.
I'm not
thing
so
to do.
Sure. Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think so either. But there's nothing wrong
not
with
him
being
in particular.
But, yeah, yeah. But what I'm saying is, if I was, well, no, I don't want to presume that. It would be a great pleasure to be wildly successful and never having to do anything, that I could just sit around and, you know, meditate on who God is all the time. I can't foresee that ever happening in my life,
all but the time. It's just his favorite thing to do.
His favorite thing. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
He's still out there in the world doing all the other stuff.
Yeah.
But
well, that's sad for me. That's sad to hear for sure.
Sadness to it. There's a lot of sadness to it, but it's still interesting in the sense. I think that when people achieve material wealth, they probably have an opportunity to experience things that people don't have that wealth do. And then to find out the other side of that, yeah, it wasn't as great or it wasn't as fulfilling, or there are other things that are more fulfilling. it's one thing to hypothesize about it. It's another thing to meet someone who's gone through that. You could mm-hmm. learn from them. You don't have to, whether they've been smart or not smart about how they live their life. You can learn from them. You can learn from that answer, but it's still, there's more groundedness to it to someone who's gone through it in some regards. And so answer that question for themselves and then still got that answer we suspect they'd have.
Yeah. But I mean, man, I tell you what I want to find joy in, the most satisfying thing I want to find joy in at the end of life is, you know, watching my children have children and watching my grandkids. I mean, that's
good point.
Yeah, for sure. I think that speaks to the hollowness of his life. If that's the most enjoyable thing.
I think that wealth does not bring the fulfillment that one would seek.
No, absolutely.
I think that's the answer there. But it's interesting to meet the person who spent their life maybe making those mistakes or whatever it is, but just trying to go that route and finding out it didn't work out versus someone who can hypothesize and maybe avoid those mistakes, but still doesn't know for themselves. But it was fascinating. My final question for you is, what is the Christian case for Bitcoin? And is that different than the Jewish case? Is it different than the religious case we've already made?
That's a great question. I think that the great faiths of our time, you know, if we start with, you know, polytheism and pantheism and think of Buddhism and, you know, they aspire to great things and want peace. And so to some respects, Bitcoin is just, should be just as fundamentally important to Hinduism or Buddhism as it is to Christianity, because, you know, religion is about finding that higher presence and meaning in life. And Bitcoin makes sense in that quest. I think if you look at Islam, there's a significant importance placed upon sound money. So I think definitely there's an Islamic case for Bitcoin, no question. I think if you look at the Jewish case for Bitcoin, it's really hard to look at even a cursory review of the Old Testament is pretty obvious that the Lord demands that money, weights, scales are honest. And so it's definitely there's a Jewish case for Bitcoin. And then I think with coming to Christianity, I think that, you know, one of my favorite graphics that I came up for one of my books is this thing called the shadow truth. And there are so many parallels between Christianity and Bitcoin. Like, you know, you think about what Satoshi did and the sacrifice that he made. He could have easily benefited himself, but he didn't. He gave this gift for us to enjoy. And you can think about the sacrifice of Jesus. You think about the immutability of Bitcoin, and you think about the immutability of God. You think about the social aspects to equality and justice that is pervasive in the Christian ethos and Jewish ethos for that matter, but particularly in the Christian ethos. So there's no reason why every moral religion and faith of the world cannot aspire to use Bitcoin for its use. But I think in its highest form, Bitcoin is definitely Christ-like, no question in my mind.
Well, there, you know, obviously astounding parallels between Christ and Bitcoin, or Christ and Satoshi, as they. I'm Jewish. I've always identified in that manner. I've struggled with religion, around organized religion, authority. I think personally, submission. I think I've questioned religion. I think that But the parallels between Bitcoin and sort of an immaculate conception or sort of like a divine gift are really fascinating. I just find that the conversation around religion is incredibly personal. And so it's hard for me to kind of have that maybe openly, because I struggle with it myself and where it fits in my life and how to sort of interact with something bigger than me and my family. And but what I loved what you said, like the sort of all the cases for Bitcoin, including the Jewish case.
Cedric, if I may, let me just interject. I think that one of the things that I found in my early discussions with Tomer and, you know, my now really good friendship with him is that Tomer was Jewish by faith, not by practice. He was an atheist, but it was the truth. It was the truth in Bitcoin that really got him wondering. And I think in our material world and our deterministic world, to have something like Bitcoin speak to this immutable truth that you can't alter speaks to something else. You know, for the first time, I think objectively, the world has something that can't be dismissed because it's right there in front of us. And so if that truth exists and is immutable and can't change, what was the model for that truth? What was the model for that immutability? And so for me, that's the leap. That is the mental arc that must be crossed. And I fundamentally believe that if you live the life as a Bitcoiner who believes fundamentally in immutable truth, you're being intellectually dishonest if you do not discover or explore if there is a reflection of some other fundamental immutable truth that exists in the world. And for me, that would be the transcendent Yahweh, God. That's the wrestling right there.
Yeah, I mean, that speaks to me a lot, especially around truth, ethics, and immutable morals. I think morals are just absolute, and they're not up for sort of debate amongst different people or different times or, you know, different places. I think of spirituality as sort of the final challenge. And maybe not the final, maybe the first challenge, but it's between you and your mind or your creator, I think. And that's very, I grew up Jewish. I'm Jewish now. I love being Jewish, but I'm not very much into organized religion I'm not against it either. I haven't worked out all my feelings towards all these things.
I know, no. I know. Cedric, but it may come. Go ahead.
I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Cedric, it may come as a surprise to you, but Jesus was a Jew.
not a surprise. So, but what do you think, though, then where we are in terms of society right now? And I feel that religion and God have been sort of not just pushed to the side, like stomped on in society. And whether you believe in God or think that God should have a role in everyone's life through the state or not, I think we're thinking, but like, I do think most people would argue that religion brings a lot of morality to society. Mm-hmm. But I don't think religion is seen in a healthy light by society right now. Mm-hmm. What is your take on that?
Well, that view is the view of the skeptic, which is fine. I think that our view of religion right now over the last 20 years has probably been tainted by, you know, the scandal of the Catholic Church and pedophilia, the lavishness of the Catholic Church, sometimes atrocities that are committed by church organizations. But I think that anybody would be foolish not to think that the church relieves so much suffering in the world. You know, on my mission trips to Guatemala, I've been all over the world on mission trips to India, Ukraine, Guatemala. Every summer when we get on a plane to go to Guatemala, if it's the right time of the summer, usually the planes coming out of Atlanta down to Guatemala are just filled with teams going down to Guatemala to do good work. So to think that the church is not relieving suffering is just a very naive view of religion. And I don't think that this aspect of spirituality needs to start with, you know, is there a God or not? I think that where it needs to start with is, what is truth and where did it come from? Mm. And then that's where you go. Don't try to put your preconceived notion of who God is in a box before you even understand what truth is and go down that pathway. And you know, it is not a cliche. You shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. So, that's the problem with our analysis of religion is we have so many presuppositions that we use without a fresh slate. And one of the things I do in my book, my first book, is I start in the period of the Renaissance and down to modern age. And I catalog with the help of Francis Schaeffer, who is a well-known Christian author of the last century, but catalog from the time of the Renaissance until modern time, why we slowly got away from putting God at the center of everything that we did in culture. And we just have these presuppositions that have been, it's like our fiat mindset. We have these presuppositions about money that we don't know where they came from. We don't know why they're there. But when we see Bitcoin, we know something's wrong. And it's the same thing with religion. We have these presuppositions. And unless you have a truth bearer to point what's wrong about your presuppositions, you'll be blind the entire time.
Yeah. I mean, always be seeking, always be questioning. What do you think of Satoshi then? And we have no proof that Satoshi wasn't mining under a name we might know or not know, mm-hmm. and accumulating mm-hmm. Satoshis under a different account, and spending Satoshis or manipulating the market or whatever you could do with all that wealth. But if the story is what we understand it to be and Satoshi hasn't moved his coins, we have no idea who Satoshi is. We can't find out who's not even the state, the all-powerful state who knows everybody mm-hmm. online can know who this person is mm-hmm. unless they've already done something with this person. What do you make of that?
I think it's awesome. I think that
that's not human-like.
No, it is human-like. It was very wise. Satoshi was a wise person. And Satoshi wanted to leave a legacy. I mean, I ascribe to the fact that he probably was a programmer who probably either had a terminal illness or killed himself, just based on the history of what goes on. Go ahead. Yeah.
I'll throw it in like Noah. I guess Noah was human-like, but
yes,
you know, took on a project of astonishing proportions and global yes. consequence.
Yes.
And got noted differently than most other contemporaries.
Yes. I don't know if I... So Cedric, there's where, for me, that analogy wouldn't work because I feel like obviously Noah was chosen by God and there was a divine movement to use him through history of the Jewish people, and that lineage and that history goes on for millennia in the Bible. So do I think that Satoshi was chosen by God to give us Bitcoin? To the extent that if I'm a great violinist, God's given me a great gift to play a violin. And so I think for Satoshi, he was a genius. There's no question about the fact that he was a genius. I think it's highly unlikely that he's still alive. I mean, about several months ago, the people that got the coins from the Mt. Gox heist were two people in New York City kind of flaunting their wealth. And I mean, it wasn't even that much money. So the point is that, you know, someone with that kind of wealth, that's just too immense to at least kind of put a little finger up, you know, that was me. So I think Satoshi's dead, and I think he did a great work, and, you know, it's like the, you know, what if Leonardo da Vinci, what if we didn't know who Leonardo da Vinci was? We knew his name, but all we had were his inventions. We'd think the same thing about Leonardo, you know?
Maybe I have to look at Leonardo. I'm not familiar enough with that. I think that I agree. I think the most logical explanation is that Satoshi's dead. That just makes the most sense to me when I think about it in that regard. But when I go down that path, I think it's too coincidental. And, you know, that you come up with the greatest invention in last.
But he didn't know that at the time. It was too early. There's no way he knew that at the time.
Fair enough, but still passed away shortly after it. So either from age-related symptoms or, you know, some other thing. So it just seems very coincidental that you're not, you know, you know, Edison didn't die, you know, 3 days after finding XYZ or 3 years after, you know.
Yeah, I hear you.
Some people live to see a generation of their work.
It's a great story.
Steve
There's no
Jobs
question about it.
Young, he saw some of his work, and Bill Gates is alive. It's a beyond the pale story. It hurts my mind to think about that, and the way that it would hurt my mind to think about God. And when I say hurt my mind, I mean in a good way, to ponder the complexities and the things I can't comprehend. It seems like one of those kind of situations, something I can't comprehend. And then none of us can, in my opinion. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation. I can't wait to get down to Guatemala, hang out there, maybe meet up in Georgia. But I really appreciate your time. I hope we got to cover everything that you're hoping to cover. Please let everyone know where they could find you, and how they can help and what they can do to help Lago Bitcoin.
Great. Thanks, Cedric. It's been a great pleasure to finally do this with you. And I appreciate the platform and your time. Yeah, people can follow me personally on Twitter because I'm an ENT surgeon. They can follow me at ENT Surge on Twitter. And then the Bitcoin Lake Project, they can follow me at Lake Bitcoin. So it's backwards. Think of Lago Bitcoin, but Lake Bitcoin on Twitter. And I've also published all of the articles about our plans and all that on Medium. So you can just type in Bitcoin Lake on Medium and you should be able to find that. And I think, you know, really the way to support is to just engage on Twitter if you're interested in seeing. Really, one of the other things about the project was I really wanted the community to be involved and be a part of this. So please follow on Twitter. I do pizza days and I do ice cream for the kids at the school. And we asked Twitter to send sats. And so, you know, you can send sats to Guatemala for the kids. And that's a great way. And then just if you're following me on Twitter, I usually keep everybody posted on my trips down there and what we're doing. So I'd love to have anybody come down. We had a group of about 12 people this last time that just came from all over just to see what we're doing. It was fantastic. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. This has been so dope. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
This episode was brought to you by CipherSafe. Check out CypherSafe.io to keep your sats safe and get 10% off your seed storage devices using the code MATRIX. If you enjoy the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, please tell your friends and family about the show. Give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform and support our sponsors. Those are some of the best ways to help the show gain awareness, grow, and become sustainable so we can keep bringing you fresh and dope conversations with the most interesting people in the space. And as always, thank you for listening. Stack sats, stay humble, and stay laser focused out there. This is Sed. Peace.